You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Great. So welcome, everybody, a really impressive group. Dan Gilmore comes to us from the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship, where he is a professor of digital entrepreneurship, and he is also a Berkman Center faculty associate. He's here to talk to us about Media Active, his new book and his new project. Welcome, Dan.
I'm going to just whip through a bunch of slides. The luncheon format is to try and be more conversation than lecture, so I want to just show you what I'm working on and think about where we're heading with, in particular, what my focus on this new book was to update the traditional media literacy notions for the digital age. And it is a pretty much a follow-on to my last book, but it's certainly not the same. And I wanted to, by the way, point out that the editor of the book is Tom Stites, and he's here, and he did my instructions to Tom when he came into the project were, don't let me off the hook. And I'm grateful that Tom did not let me off the hook, even when it was really pissing me off. So, what amazes me is that this guy has more followers than I do, and, you know, what can I say? Let's review where we've come from in media, and then we'll go to where we're, I think, heading. The cave drawings, a kind of early form of media in kind of the way we think of media. And forgive me, I lived in Silicon Valley so long that I put version numbers on everything. Maybe the papyrus, the scrolls, the Gutenberg Bible breakthrough, major event in media, the printing press, movable type. The profound things that happened as a result of this, including the fact that the word of God was wrested from the control of the priests, pretty big deal, and the priesthood of today is also seeing its control eroded, which is also a good thing. Maybe this is very Western focused, but the pamphleteers in the revolutionary days in the U.S. might be a 1.1 telegraph, 1.5, very fast over long distances, but still one-to-one essentially. Then the breakthrough is broadcast to the next version of media, the one to many long distances real quick. TV, a big deal, but not as big a deal as the one we're at. This famous diagram from Claude Shannon, the information theorist, is kind of how media worked in the 20th century. That's another version of it that I did that is more about journalism. But that's really the way the information flowed. But the world we're in now is a very different thing, and the theory of 21st century, that's a typo, should be more like that, and I don't know what it's going to be, except that we're in a democratized media era of participation in the tools of creation and production being ubiquitous, in everyone's hands, from this to this and all sorts of other tools. And the other democratizing thing being access, and this is important for me to emphasize, the traditional media model was one where we created stuff and then manufactured it into either a printed product or a broadcast self-enclosed thing and then distributed the result. That's not what we do now. Today we create stuff and we put it somewhere and we make it available and people come and get it. A totally flipped on its end model that I don't think traditional media people still quite understand because of the way they behave. That suggests that they don't quite understand. The read-write web, the consumer is creator is collaborator, That, to me, is actually the most exciting potential for the future. So, real quickly, about the book, it was I was looking at the ideas of supply and demand in a kind of abstract way, and I realized, and I don't think this is a surprise to anyone here, that we have a pretty ample supply coming along. And we ask about who's the journalist in this era, and I'm saying that's the wrong question. It's what journalism is. And my media focus is on quality information that you might call journalism at some level. And so we can agree that that's journalism. We can agree that's not, I hope. By the way, I celebrate the fact that someone creates that. That's fine, but it's not journalism. But it gets fuzzier when we get into what is happening with this democratized media. This woman named Nida, who was shot in the street in Tehran after the violence there a couple of years ago and after the election. This was a part of a video caught by someone with a mobile phone camera, a video camera. And it was an act of journalism, no question about that, an act of creating part of what became our understanding of that day. And in fact, so much an act of journalism that it won the George Polk Award, which is actually one of the few journalism awards that actually mean something. Most journalism awards are meaningless in every way that matters. No other profession gives itself so many prizes as journalism. It's kind of pathetic. And equally, no event has been so thoroughly captured in Japan. We're going to be seeing people piecing together, aggregating pieces of things from that over the next few years. And all kinds of things are going to stem from that in our understanding of media. But it's very much, even though I don't think I saw this on TV anywhere, this was part of the ecosystem of media that's developing and incredibly important to see what happens and to archive and to tell the stories of these things. This is a blog. It's never been in print, but it's journalism. It's flat-out useful stuff with a worldview that is easy to understand. Ori Okola, the founder of a wonderful project called Ushahidi, was covering the Kenyan parliament that she thought was not being covered well by the news media and doing a better job. Is she a journalist? Absolutely, no question. The WikiLeaks thing we could spend all day on, but clearly part of the media ecosystem in a way that is new, or at least evolving, and I would want to protect them as journalists in every way that we would protect a journalist in other ways, raising the question of whether journalists should have any special protection for what they do in news gathering. I'm not going to touch on that here, but if there are going to be protections, then clearly WikiLeaks deserves them too. What I'm getting at is it's an and world, not an or world. It's not bloggers or journalists, bloggers and journalists, and if we need to understand that. And that adaptation is happening because it doesn't cost anything to try new media projects. The barrier is zero to entry, and that's a wonderful thing. And we're ending up with an ecosystem of media that's quite spectacular and early days of this changing thing. I was at a conference this weekend called Media Reform, right? So you can imagine a conference with that name. You start off with a bunch of people who think that everything is bad. And I was kind of the resident optimist in the place. How can I be pessimistic when there's so much experimentation going on and when we're going to see something emerge from this? I'm just sure of it. So I'm not worried about supply. Feels to me like we're going to have plenty of it. The issues, there are a lot of issues about what we do with that supply, which we're going to talk about here for a second. But I think we have a issue of demand that is a problem that we need to work on in general. This has been the way people got media in general, at least in America for a long time, sitting back. And I'm a fan of laying back on the couch and emptying my brain into the television. That's not I like doing that. But I don't think that's the way we should engage with the media that we need to use to make good decisions. Not anymore. That there are other issues, including the fact there's too much information and so much of it is garbage. And this is part of the core questions that we have to answer for ourselves, and we have ways to do it. Furthermore, we have the issue of what we can trust in a more ethical sense, what's true, what's not, when in a world of Photoshop, which is, think of Photoshop and all the things like it, we end up with images like that, which are composites, completely fake, and yet which race around the world before they are even debunked. And even though this was debunked rather quickly, it probably was seen by a lot of people who think that it was a real picture. I think one thing I won't spend time on, but we have tools with digital media that give us the potential for the first time to chase down the lies with the truth and to actually catch up. This is the first time it's ever been possible because of digital media. And if you want to talk about that later, why I believe that ask, please bring it up. And it's not just these, you know, so-called bloggers in pajamas and pranksters, but our biggest media organizations get things catastrophically wrong at times. And we have an ecosystem that is in some disrepair at the journalistic level, and I'm still not depressed, even though it may look that way. What the book was really founded on, and actually the book started here at Berkman or at Harvard Law School about 2 years ago with a talk just like this one, although in a smaller room, where I basically laid out what I thought were going to be principles that I would design a book around. And I pretty much held to that. I'm happy to say that talk led several people to say, well, you're missing things, which they were right about, and which I got to include in the final book. I'm sorry Ethan Zuckerman's not here. I would give him a big hug for having pushed me in the right direction. But the principles are about using media as consumers, not being consumers, and that we have, if we are to be literate, we must participate, and that in doing it with integrity matters. If we want to be trusted in this world of flow of information, the way it's going in and out, we have an obligation to ourselves. I mean, I don't know why someone wants to be Andrew Breitbart, who has a reputation for deception in pursuit of his political goals. Why would I would never want to have that as my methodology, because why would you want to be sort of automatically distrusted by the majority of people who look at your stuff? So the principles, and I'll spend not too much time, just quickly go through them. We have to be skeptical, but of everything, including the New York Times, including the BBC, including the best journalists. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to be equally skeptical. And this is one of the things that some of our kids don't quite get, is that they are equally skeptical of things, except for their friends, who they, on many topics, should be more skeptical of. But that's a cultural change, and we're going to have to find our way through it. But we have to use judgment. So I have a little thing that I call my credibility scale. And I'll spend a second on this, because it actually feels like something works for me when I do this. I have a notion that things start out with plus more credibility or less. And so the average BBC piece starts out with pretty high positive credibility, and an anonymous comment on a random blog would start off pretty far down. But what I want you to notice is that it doesn't go from zero to positive. it goes into negative. So the anonymous commenter in this case would have to work really hard just to have no credibility. That certain media sucks credibility out of the ecosystem. And that we need to think of it that way. That this is, for me, a really useful way of focusing on what I can trust and what I can't. I don't trust absolutely, but I find this helps me in my work. Another principle, and these are really obvious, so forgive me, but you know, ask questions. Duh. The more, I don't mean by this that we should go get on a plane to Afghanistan and re-report the New York Times stories, but we should ask questions, especially about things we care about, to get more information, and that can mean going to other media sources, which we ought to do automatically. And I put in this context Wikipedia because it's one of the things that constantly comes up. People say, well, we can't trust Wikipedia, and academics have this loathing of Wikipedia, which I think is nuts, because Wikipedia is often, if not most of the time, the best place to start. But it's usually the worst possible place to stop. And at the bottom of any good Wikipedia article is a long list of original sources that are the things you should go to next. That's how to use Wikipedia, and I love it when my students do that because it's the right way to do it. And incidentally, I posed that framing to Jimmy Wales, and he said, yeah, exactly. So if he agrees with that, I think I'm more likely I'm right than not. Still could be wrong. Another principle, and this is where I give a big shout out to Ethan Zuckerman, who is not here. This was not in my original set of principles, and I, you know, thank you, Ethan, thank you. He explained to me why it needed to be, that we have to go outside, deliberately outside of our own biases and worldviews and experiences as we use media. And that takes many, many forms, one of which is to, for me, to go to Global Voices Online, the project Ethan co-founded, which is blogs from around the world, outside North America, that look at world issues in a big way. It was a powerful help in understanding what was going on, is going on in North Africa and the Middle East, and many, many other places. It's not the be-all, end-all, but it's a terrific thing. It's going outside of my cultural comfort zone is what's going on here. Another way I go outside my comfort zone is to challenge my own assumptions rigorously. And I used to keep a list. I don't think I put a picture of it here. I used to keep a list in my desk of, when I was a columnist, you know, writing about business and technology, things I believe. And it said, and the number, and this was a list of 10 things that were not about moral issues, but about things that affected the technology and business world and policy that I kind of took for granted and that were at the core of my work as a columnist. So for a long time, the number one thing on the list said, Microsoft is an abusive monopoly and needs a lot of government supervision. And I had this list of 10. It was in the back of my desk drawer. And every 6 months, I'd save 2 or 3 days and pull the list out and attack it. Call the people up who I knew disagreed and thought I was wrong. And say, okay, tell me what's changed. What's wrong with this? You know, why am I now wrong? And just to go after each of these things I thought I'd understood better. And things would fall off the list. Some things would come on the list. Things would move around on the list. Microsoft never moved very far. But it was for me a great exercise in going outside of my comfort zone. And it helped me a lot to actually understand how things were changing. Because if in technology, if you don't challenge your thinking, especially in tech, you will be wrong. And it will happen sooner than you think. Final one is techniques for, this is for the so-called consumers, to learn media techniques, especially, I don't mean by that just how to take a mobile phone picture and put it on YouTube, video on YouTube, but to understand the principle, how media is used to persuade. or manipulate, as it is often done. Our kids are great at creating media print stuff. They're not so great. In fact, most of us are not so great at the understanding the how media are used to change our minds or to move us in directions. So there's places like SourceWatch that I think are terrific resources to find out who's behind the PR in certain things. They track opinion industry, which is pretty amazing, big industry. So for the creators of media, and I'll repeat, I don't believe we are literate in a modern world without being media creators. I think we're only part of the way there. And it was the same was true with the traditional media literacy. If you didn't write, you weren't particularly literate either. But now it's complicated more so than ever. And again, I'm focused on this in a journalistic sense. I don't mean journalism, but journalistic, and certainly not journalists. That the first ones apply, but then you get into the standard ones, like being thorough. You can do all kinds of things. Being accurate, these are sort of duh. But my commitment to accuracy is that if you find an error, if you're the first one to find an error in the book, I promise that you'll get a free copy of the next print edition. That's part of my way of moving ahead on this, because God knows there are mistakes in the book, and I want to make sure they aren't. As Esther says, Esther Dyson says, always make new mistakes. So the next version of the book will have new mistakes, but not the old ones. That's my goal. Fairness, again, is standard journalistic principle. With digital media, we actually have new ways to be fairer, including something that the New York Times tried once, as far as I can tell, which was a shame that only did it once. But they did a piece on a congressman, tough investigative piece. They got a response from under the byline of the congressman, who knows who wrote it, but saying it's wrong in these ways. And then the reporter right next to it says, well, here are the facts I've got. It stopped there, which is too bad. I think it would have been better to continue that and really thrash it through more. And they also, as far as I know, haven't done this again. But I think it was great that they did. I think a right of reply is a fundamental value we should, as journalists, those of us who are doing it, or people who are creating media, if we're going to say something about other people or institutions, that they should have a right to chime in, and not necessarily only in the comments buried below. Maybe right next to it. Independence is another value and principle of media that journalists generally try to follow, even though they often can't do it, as in the case of a real scandal in journalism, which was the way the Pentagon influenced and the military contractors influenced TV coverage, undisclosed to the viewers of these TV news shows. There were people with direct connections, and financial ones as well, to the Pentagon and the military industry, who were proclaiming the goodness of Guantanamo and the war. So, and this won a Pulitzer Prize, this story, and interestingly enough, NBC News, one of the major violators, in announcing the 5 Pulitzer Prizes the Times won that year, they named 3 of them, but oddly enough, didn't mention this one, which was the most important of the Pulitzers. And that really goes to the value, to the principle of media that I think is not traditional but needs to be part of our future, which is transparency. And it's fundamentally been absent in the past, and I'm convinced it needs to be ingrained in the future. David Weinberger here has done a terrific piece. He said that transparency is the new objectivity, and we disagree a little bit on that, but what he's getting at is that I think it's part of the new objectivity, absolutely, and I do recommend his piece. It's terrific. Fundamentally, this is how we're going to help people understand that what we do can be trusted or not trusted, and explaining our worldviews feels good, but there are a lot of other ways to be transparent. I should say that I don't mind advocacy journalism. I actually love it. I just like to know what the advocates are doing. And I love journalism with a worldview. I just would like it if they'd say so. So, you know, the Washington Post had a worldview in the run-up to the Iraq War, which was go to war. Do it. And yet they didn't just say so. I think if they had said so, as not just the editorial page, which was gung-ho, but clearly the news pages were part of this thing, and I wish they had just said it. When I go to London, I buy The Guardian and I buy The Telegraph. The Guardian is reliably somewhat left of center and very overt about it. The Telegraph is reliably somewhat right of center and no question about it. They both do terrific journalism, guided by their worldviews, but they also both challenge their assumptions and they do journalism about things that shows things that don't conform to their worldview, but they have a worldview. And I read them both and I figure I'm kind of triangulating on British establishment reality. And I think we can all do that. I'm not smarter than anybody. Anybody can do that, and we all should think about media in this way, but we need their help to do it. The other things that media can do, that are traditional media have lots of avenues for transparency that they don't use. And this is an example of explaining how a story was done. The reporter said, this makes no sense about a medical situation, and here's how I found out what was going on. Kind of a detective story. It was great, very transparent. And Wikipedia is transparent on many levels, one of which is every comma that's ever been added to an article is archived and you can find it. That's pretty good. I think why not have change logs for articles that are updated in journalism? There's projects to do this, but no one's actually doing it in the world of journalism. So that's what the book is about, and I wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about another part of this that several people have asked me about, which is one of the things I'm doing with this project is to try and figure out in my own mind what a book is. I'm not sure anymore what a book is. Yeah, I know it's that thing that you hold that has pages. And I love that form, by the way. I like holding books. I also like reading them with a Kindle app or various other kinds of e-readers. But digital world gives us new ideas, and please don't even think that I'm a pioneer here. I'm kind of a long distant follower of more interesting people, but here's how I'm experimenting with what a book is. So the whole thing's available on the website in PDF for download, and all the pages and chapters are up in various ways. The reason I do that is because I believe in something called Creative Commons, here at Harvard, a lot of people know that, but for those who may not be familiar, it's a copyright license that says, instead of all rights reserved, some rights reserved. And the ones I reserve say, anybody can download the book and copy it for free, for non-commercial purposes. If they remix it in some way, they got to give me credit and release whatever that remix is under the same license. That's it. The theory is, and it's a theory more than anything else, is that if anyone's going to make money on it, it should be me. That seems fair to me. But I also want to spread the ideas. That's crucial to me. And the last book was published that way. And you know, I'm still getting royalty checks from a 6.5-year-old book because it was free for download the day it went into bookstores. That's not counterintuitive. If you want to talk about that later, we can. And the publisher that offered me a deal this time said no to Creative Commons, so I said no to the publisher, and I'm self-publishing. So I used Lulu, and that's one way of doing it. I've also been working on ebook editions, learning some pretty crappy software. We need better software for this than we have. Finding lots of ways to do it. I'm also publishing on Amazon's CreateSpace site, which is another self-publisher. The ins and outs of this are, give me headaches in so many ways. And I'm going to be doing some long blog posts about how self-publishing is wonderful and hugely annoying at the same time, and how it could be a lot better. But I'm happy to do it. It's funny because it's available on Amazon through the Lulu channel and through my own channel. And at one point, Amazon cut the Lulu price, even though they make more money on the one that I do through Amazon. They cut the price on the other one, pushing sales there. So I had to actually cut my price to match Amazon's price so that they could make more money. I'm going to write about this. This is insane. And Amazon, when I called them, they said, can't be helped. The algorithm did it. It wasn't their words, but that's the truth. It's
the algorithm did it.
Somebody's going to write a mystery someday that nobody has a butler anymore except for investment bankers. But everyone has an algorithm. So the algorithm did. Stuff that's coming up, some foreign editions, version 2, and some various things. Working on with a former student, an electronic e-book for a tablet that will have actually a game inside of it. We're working on how to do that. I'm thinking about the game along these lines, which is here's a journalism story. Some of it is BS. Here are some tools. Find the BS. I'm not sure how to make that work as a game, but we're iterating now to figure out how that will. And it may be a bad idea. If you have anyone with a good idea for a game inside this book, please let me know because I want to try it. But I'm experimenting. This is all part of the what is a book thing. This is not posted publicly yet, but the entire thing is now on the web. I'm going to make it public very soon, with it possible to comment on any individual paragraph. And this is where I'm going to rewrite the book in public with strike-throughs and new stuff in like green text or something. So people can comment, and I just put a sample comment there that is, I hope, not what people will normally do, but it's just a thought that why not annotate it? I had thought about putting it in a wiki and then realized I didn't have time to curate the wiki. It would take a lot of work. So if you do a wiki, you actually have to pay attention to it. You can't just let it sit there and expect things to be fine. It doesn't work that way. So that's where I'm going. This is for anyone who wants to reach me, and I don't want to talk at you the whole time. I really want to hear your questions and thoughts. Yes, sir.
What do you think about New York Times?
Oh, wait. Amr wants to. This is being webcast, so hold the mic, please.
What do you think about the New York Times decision of charging for its online paper? Is it going to survive, or optimistic or not?
I'm completely in favor of paywalls. I'm completely in favor of not having paywalls. I'm completely in favor of any experiment that any news organization or startup wants to try, because we don't know what the business models, and that's a plural, not a singular, of tomorrow's media are going to be. We don't know yet. We have some speculation. We have some experiments. And my thought is, let's have a million experiments and see what works. So I hope that the New York Times paywall works. It's rumored that they spent tens of millions of dollars figuring out how to do it. I find that startling, given the way it works. But great. We get the Sunday Times delivered at home. It turns out that if you get the Sunday Times, never mind all week, but just the Sunday Times delivered, you get access to all the digital stuff. Interestingly, it's less expensive to buy the Sunday Times and get everything than to buy just the digital. If that's deliberate, it's more subtle than I understand. But it may be deliberate. Maybe the more revenue from more subscribers to the National Sunday Times is actually worth it. That's probably what's going on. It may be that simple. Yes, try everything. The London Times has had a pretty obvious failure with its paywall, at least from my perspective. But the New York Times is trying a lot of things. But the point is that lots and lots and lots of experiments are going on, and I don't know the answer. I'm just watching like everyone else to see. But do everything, and we'll keep the stuff that works. That's my view. One of Tom here, who's doing the Banyan Project, he's creating a news co-op, of which there are a few around the world, but none that are serious in America. And I'm hoping that's going to really work. That's a potentially great idea for a business model. Yeah?
Two questions.
Can you get the mic?
They're sort of related but not related, I guess. One related to the try all experiments, which I'm a believer and liver of that philosophy. But I was just reading an article this couple days ago in the Times about, yesterday I think it was, about Katie Couric's stint at CBS and probably going to be going out of contract, and that they spent a whole bunch of time saying, let's try stuff. And pretty much was, in a way, was rejected by the viewership, 60 years old, around median mm-hmm. age, they said. So I wonder about, do you think that's just this tension between the traditional forms versus trying new stuff all the time, and that's a whole mindset in of itself that's not caught up yet to mainstream? That's my first quick question.
Sure, let me address that quickly. Yeah, there's always a tension between people's ingrained habits, and they get more ingrained the older they get, typically, and new ideas and new ways of looking at things. In many ways, I'm stuck in some place. I'm not going to be the one who figures this out and really gets it all right. It'll be my students or their kids who are more equipped. I mean, it doesn't mean that getting older prevents you from having good thoughts. Witness the Banyan Project. But it just means that it's human nature that we settle into patterns, and that it's a little harder to get out of them than not impossible. So it doesn't surprise me that CBS News would not succeed in this, but I'm glad to hear that they're trying, if that's true.
The other quick question, I think if I heard correctly, was that you actually made money even though you offered the book for free, and
yeah.
You said you'd revisit that if somebody asked, so I'm asking. I'm curious.
Well, because there were a number of things about that are worth pointing out. First of all, for the kinds of books that I write, they're part of a sort of personal ecosystem of the ideas that goes beyond the simple book. But when We the Media was published, it was ignored by reviewers in this country. It got, as far as I know, one newspaper review, and that was the newspaper I worked for. And having it available and having it out there and me talking about it and other people therefore able to talk about it with, in serious ways, helped a lot. It was, because again, I believed that this was about the ideas in it and the looking into the future a bit, and to something I believe in deeply, and the same applies to this one. So that turned out to be a good marketing strategy. But I'm also committed vehemently to the copyright system being reformed, and being used. That copyright, which I value, has been hijacked by crooks, as far as I'm concerned, and by people who don't believe in the open standing on each other's shoulders method of improvement that has been our tradition and the human nature. They want to kind of restrict that. So that's the other reason I do it. And the other thing is that I also make some money giving talks, and the more people who can read what I talk about, the more likely I'll get hired to give talks. So there's a lot of reasons for doing this, but I'd do it if none of the financial stuff was there. I really would, because it just seems like the only right way to do it.
Just a quick question. I'm sure you know what Seth Godin is up to with this Domino project, publishing with Amazon. Mm-hmm. He does a video where he talks about what publishing model is and that it serves the booksellers. Mm-hmm. And he says we need a publishing model that serves, ready, readers. And I wondered, can you comment on that whole? I mean, I think you bring up so many important points that who's making it and who's reading it and where all that's going is shifting and changing all the time.
If the readers, in the end, the audience is the reason for doing it. It's clear that there are many more possibilities for making things more interesting for the audience than ever before. One of them is actually getting them into the conversation about the work. I think a lot of the new models that people like Seth and others are exploring, the readers an equal partner in some ways, but you know it's also about fundamentally the author doing better than in the past, because their incentives do matter, and the publishing industry has made a big mistake, in my view, with the way it does e-books in every possible way. Not just that they've raised prices dramatically, but that they screw the authors. The authors actually get much worse deals on e-books than they do on the bound ones. In terms of the overall revenues and share. So it's no surprise to me that authors are starting to desert the traditional publishers, and may they do so at an increasing rate. This is not all joy to do it this way. In fact, it's kind of problematic in many ways. There are barriers, very difficult barriers to overcome with selling into bookstores that I'm actually thinking about finding a distribution deal for the book through a regular publisher, because it would certainly be at a different contractual basis than if I did it the traditional way. But there are reasons that the publishing industry exists that are not all bad, and they've done a lot of good things. They're just hopelessly out of their context at this point, and they're not sure what to do about it. Yeah.
On the topic of supply and demand and that flip that we've seen, so now we not only have an abundance of supply, we have the overabundance of supply. And then when that first happened, a lot of people talked about curators and curatorial, which, of course, the real meaning of that is a very deep, considered knowledge of a specific topic area, if you think mm-hmm. of it in the museum world. And what we've been seeing online is almost, you'll have to correct me if I'm mistaken, almost the exact opposite. It's almost like a cut, copy, paste type of curatorial. Or what I wanted to get at was your thoughts on curating and aggregating.
The best aggregation is a curation is curating, because it's done with judgment. I mean, I don't make this distinction quite so much, and I think actually curation is very much part of the future. And we're already seeing it. Some of my curators are domain experts who have blogs and Twitter feeds that I find immensely useful and that I sort. The joy of this is, in many ways, is that with traditional media, there was never even the possibility of going deep on niche topics. You couldn't do it unless you wanted to go spend hours and hours and hours in libraries and buying magazines that no one could afford or find typically and things like that. Now you can, whatever the topic is, you can go deep. And there will be somebody out there who's actually paying more attention to it than any journalist, call it or not. It's a domain expert who can guide you to the best stuff.
Right, and in that way, I think that's the lesson of Wikipedia, but my concern is around things like the biggest aggregators, the big getting bigger. So the biggest aggregators getting the most attention, the Huffington Post type of
thing. Always a tendency for critical mass to gain, to therefore create this. And there are different kinds of aggregation. I have to say I'm not a fan. Some of what the Huffington Post does is terrific. I'm not against it, although I'm quite critical of some of the way they've behaved. The part of their aggregation that I find unconscionable, and they're not alone and they're not the worst, is the kind of aggregation that takes a story that someone's reported thoroughly, summarizes it in with long quotes in ways that walk right up to the edge of fair use, if not over, and which make it completely unnecessary to go look at the original. Now, there are two possibilities. One is that the original was too long and it wasn't worth writing that much anyway, which is often true. But the other is that it's a deliberate attempt to capture the attention that in a more fair system would go to the original. So I make it a personal practice whenever possible to link back through when I see something I want to link to. I try to find where did it start and go to that and link to that. I'm working on a long blog post about the link ethic as opposed to the link tactic. And that I think it would be the right thing to do is to link to the original and take that extra minute or two to find it, and that we'd be better off. But aggregation is a form of creation. It's an editing function. Editors are aggregators. The wire editor in the newspaper was just nothing but an aggregator. And we were people using their judgment to help you find better things. God bless them, I think. And we don't have the right tools, by the way. We're still in the dark ages of getting the right tools for this, not for ourselves, because I don't want to totally rely on aggregators. I want to do some of it myself with a community of like-minded people. But the tools are coming that will combine human intelligence and machine intelligence so that individuals and communities of geography and of interest will be able to help each other find the good stuff and create aggregation on the fly that is even deeper and more valuable than anything that we have today. But I wish I was 20 years younger. I'd be starting a company to do that, because that's, to me, a very big deal if it works. Question?
I enjoyed your optimism about saying that it was easier to catch lies. That seems like a wonderful thing. Can you imagine, though, that it'll actually make a difference, that as lies are caught, that they can catch up with the sources of the lies? And so if we're passive consumers of media, will it really matter?
I'll give you an example of how digital technology, if someone cared to deploy it, no one's done it yet, could do this. I don't think this would be difficult. If I had more time, I would just try and write a plugin for WordPress to do it. It's quite simple. If you agree to sign up for this service, which includes me having a cookie on your computer, and you know we'll work out the privacy stuff, and then I will make sure I will send you an email every time there's a correction to something that I know you have looked at. Done. Why isn't this routine? This could be done quite easily, but nobody does it. I don't understand why. It's not because it can't be done. In fact, it's trivial technologically. But, and you could, you know, with RSS has enough fields in it that could be tweaked to, you know, have, you know, minor, major, you know, notifications. We could do all that. But, so that's an example of how we could, you know, trivially help people who saw the wrong thing find out that it was wrong. And we need, the closest I've seen to it is that Jack Schaefer at Slate has kind of he rolled his own thing where he would, if you signed up, you would find out about all errors, whether you'd read the piece or not. But this is, so that's one of many possibilities, but more importantly, it's actually going to be that people creating media be eager to find out about their mistakes and to tell people about them and to make sure not just that the future reader doesn't see the wrong stuff, but the past reader gets caught up. Yes, sir.
Well, there certainly are factual mistakes and differences of what happened and actually didn't happen. But I think that the real interesting issue is back where you talked about before, which is what are the context markers of anything that's put out there? Is this a story that is a context of the United States of America context or a global citizen? Or is it about the benefit of the financial services industry? Those are the things that are hidden in the background. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that, as long as we're in a world of where media is individual authors, they're not likely to tease that out because it's generally not in their interest. And where I'm, as I hear your whole talk here, I, as I think several others have, the argument really seems to be that if all of the consumption issues you talked about are to be handled by anybody who's reasonable people running their lives, that's going to have the creation be a community collaborative things too, so that all of those issues are teased out in the process mm-hmm. that results in that aggregation, in the last word you used.
I gave the impression that this is going to be simple or easy. Forgive me. It's not. But it's going to be a process over some years or decades to build not just tools but mindsets and willingness on the part of creators and consumers, in quotes, to make this happen collectively.
Well, so in the transition, another business that may be an opportunity is a third-party creator of context markers. What is the context that you should read Huffington Post or this particular article or this particular author? I mean, as long as they are done by people with agendas, advocacy journalism in your words, that might be additive to the whole media world.
It's a fine idea, and then we'll need a meta level to tease out the agendas of the people who are doing the critiquing. You know, this could go endlessly, but in the end, we tend to. I think if we're never going to get it right. We're just going to always be working towards something better, and in the end, common sense. If common sense is pretty good, if you're really, you know, using the possibilities and getting out. Did someone over here, I thought, had a hand up.
There were two down
here. Come back.
Dan, I really appreciate your approach to the qualitative and the quantitative approach to the media side of it. Authenticity and transparency have always been an issue with the internet, and especially it's becoming even more so. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you agree that there's a quantitative amount more information than ever before, and it's not you're not making the argument that it's qualitatively better than it previously was. It's neutral at best.
Actually, I'm going to make the argument that given the sheer volume, even if we all agree on Sturgeon's law that 90% of everything is crap, the sheer amount more that we have means that I'm quite certain that there's more good stuff now than there ever was, and that the issue, of course, is finding it.
That kind of falls up to my question is, is the internet making the human race more intelligent, or is it making it more susceptible?
Yes.
And the follow-up to that is, how has technology changed politics?
You ask such easy questions. On the first one, when I said yes, it's obviously in my view both. We're sorting it out, and a lot of it's up to us. In the end, we look in the mirror to decide whether it's making us stupid or intelligent, and at what rate. These are decisions for us, not for some internet gods to decide. I'm pretty focused here on our role. Clay Shirky wrote a lovely foreword and actually got my elevator pitch better than I had, which was, I don't want to only upgrade the journalism part of the ecosystem, I want to upgrade us. It's harder, but I don't think we have a choice if we're going to get through this. As far as politics goes, I knew more about the internet and politics about 5 years ago than I know now. I've sort of watch it and I pay attention, I feel so unexpert. We're seeing dramatic new ways of communicating with and generating these communities of interest of people who will follow and do things. But we're also seeing people who are expert at doing things in ways that I don't approve of using these tools. So I don't know who's winning on that.
So it goes back to authenticity and trust.
It goes to the trust issue. The part that has been less explored, though it's beginning to get more so, that I'm pretty excited about, is the use of technology in governance, the stuff that happens in between election campaigns, like real life, the stuff that people who do the governing do. And we're starting to see some actual dramatic results there and we have barely begun to tap that potential, the communication of the governed with the people who do the governance.
So basically being able to authenticate, are you who you say you are, what do you allow them to do, and where do you allow them to go in the system?
Well, I'm not talking about identity systems in any way. In fact, I'm quite worried that we're being pushed to an end of anonymity, which I think would be a tragic mistake. Not that it's possible, but I think it would be terrible if the Facebook view of the world works, which is that you have one identity in all places. And that's what the government wants too, by the way. There's a building coalition there, which is dangerous. But as an example that I think pretty good. There's a site in the UK called Fix My Street, where people report problems in the infrastructure, and these are then communicated to the people who can fix the streets. and then they communicate back when they fixed it, or the people who reported it report that it's been done. That's the bare beginning of how we can start to get.
Yeah, they do that here in Boston, actually. They, I mean, there's different operational aspects of government, then there's the politics of government, mm-hmm. then there's the government's risk and compliance issue. Yeah.
But anyway, we're really early in this whole phenomenon. I think the use of the net and technology for the administration of things that government should do is pretty important and pretty unexplored, except in, you know, a few areas. I can renew my driver's license online, which I'm really grateful for, by the way, because I don't like going and standing in line. But that's trivial, but it's, you know, these things collectively save enormous amounts of time and money and energy and all sorts of things. I think we have great potential. What, Amr? One time? Okay. One more? Someone who hasn't asked you.
I'll just ask a somewhat broad question of you. I mean, I'm coming from the perspective of media in Kenya, where there is a lot of technology, a lot of internet projects, computer programmers. I mean, there's sort of a lot of activity in Nairobi around technology and internet. The media sector is extremely traditional. Mm-hmm. You know, and actually it's one of the best, you could say, in Africa in terms of actually covering stuff and publishing it in newspapers, but it's very regulated. You know, so what we're doing is training young people to use these kinds of tools. You're talking about social media and video and other tools to make their own media, basically, and to blog and things like that. But it's actually, it can be very dangerous, first of all, even though it hasn't been that life-threatening for our guys yet, but you can see how the system is set up to avoid protecting anyone that doesn't have a badge from the National Press Agency.
Right.
And then meanwhile, we've found it a little bit challenging to even explain to people what can information do? What's the role of the media? Because they do see the major media as simply kind of stirring the pot a little bit and then representing the government, one or the other. So I guess I'm just curious where, you know, if you want to internationalize this a little bit, you know, what would be your application of some of this stuff to, you know, the rest of the world, basically?
Well, in most parts of the world, the what you're talking about is working at the edges. Although that still feels somewhat true in this country. But, you know, where governments control media to begin with, you have further hurdles. Where there's less deployment of technology, you have yet more hurdles. You know, this is all going to go at different speeds in different places. But if there's not a reasonably democratic system in place with reasonable freedom of the press to begin with, this is there's more potential for getting actual useful information to people who need it. That's not being talked about by the incumbents in those places, but it's also something, you know, more risky and also harder to get it to the larger crew. But I you know, you're doing God's work. I hope you continue it. This is important stuff. I think it's not simply enough to put the tools in people's hands and assume that they're going to get it done. And that's why training, but by training I do not mean the lecture from on high about how it's done and it's not done any other way. That's how training used to work. Training is also now a conversation, and I'm just beginning to learn how that works, because I'm working on some training stuff too. So I just came back from Singapore, where it's a velvet dictatorship, and the press is highly controlled, but there are bloggers who are actually out there pushing hard. I think they have a sense of just how far they dare go, but it's a whole lot further than anything ever used to go. And I'm not satisfied with it, I'll never be fully satisfied, no one should, who believes in free expression. But I'm enjoying the progress where I see it and worried about the pullbacks that are taking place as well. I think we have to end it here. Thank you all.